A dominant opening quarter against Newcastle saw Fulham playing some high-octane football before a subtle tactical move, or shithousery, or cheating, or gamesmanship, delete as you feel appropriate, by Eddie Howe and a possibly hurt but not really hurt goalkeeper Martin Dubravka saw the Toons stifle Fulham's attack and leave the cottage with all 3 points. It was frankly pretty crap, but gives us much to moan about, as Kish, the cottage tactico, his very self, and producer Don join me to recap, vent, and prepare for the journey to the stadium, well, that we all paid for, so West Ham can play in it. I'm Boney, and this is your Fulham Focus podcast.
Fulham.
Gentlemen, and as always, I use the phrase loosely, how are we? Don, you're looking well. How is Atlanta?
We are London weather right now. More and more rain and...
Kish and I have got our curtains closed because we've got sun, mate. It's fantastic.
Well, now we're all over the place. We get warm and then we get more and more rain. So, you know.
Yeah.
If you're from England and you're in Atlanta, you probably feel like you're at home.
Except for the extreme heat and... Well, humidity.
We haven't seen the extreme heat yet. We've only gotten into the 70s, so.
This is proper for a British podcast that we open by talking about the weather. Kish, how is it in your part of our fair and windy isle?
Yes, pretty standard, to be honest. It's nice sunshine. It hasn't been raining for a bit. I've had a couple of days off work to try and digest the weekend's result, and I'm in a calm place. Not like the one we did straight after the Forest game when I was in need of therapy. So, yeah, I'm not doing too bad, thank you.
We've got quite a bit to go through because this last game on Saturday was watching it as I did because I was not sat in front of you this week, Kish, so apologies for that. Dear listener, that's not a euphemism. We're literally a row apart in H5. It was one of those games that after about 10 minutes I thought, oh crap, if we keep this up, we're going to lose because that final ball was not clicking. And that's kind of what happened. But first of all, takeaways from it, dominant performance, massive amount of possession, just lacking something again. It was like old school Muniz up front again, and again, throwing on loads of strikers at the end without a hell of a lot going. We're going to delve into it a bit more, but your first takeaways from it, Kish. What was your feeling walking out of the cottage?
I mean, I feel like I should have felt more annoyed. So, I mean, first things first, and you've told me off about this before, Boney, I made a cardinal error at the weekend, which is I took people to Craven Cottage.
Oh, dude.
I took my parents to Craven Cottage, and the last time I took sort of esteemed guests to Craven Cottage was the Burnley game, which we lost 2-0, and you were, I think, in front of me for that one.
I was, and your in-laws were lovely.
Yeah, they are very lovely, but they cursed us on the day. And unfortunately, I think my parents did the same. So I'm to blame. It's not the tactics. It's not the players on the beach. It's all my fault. I mean, I think that my mum was more annoyed than me because she's not used to it. Right. So I think every Fulham fan, when that game goes into halftime, 0-0, knew in their heart of hearts exactly what was coming because it was a great first half performance in many ways. It changed midway through the first half. I'm sure we're going to come on to that. But without that goal, I think we all knew what was coming. I'd love to say that I was really angry. I was a bit frustrated because I thought we played quite well and we weren't getting our just desserts across the whole 90 minutes. But I wasn't surprised enough to be fuming. I don't know how you guys felt.
Don.
Well, I think Kish could speak better to this, but this is how I feel. Fulham played two different ways, okay? We either are really aggressive and have possession the entire time, and then are toothless in the last third. Like, we just can't make anything happen hardly to save our lives. And then when we do get our opportunities, we can't finish it. We can't bury it in the net. So, for example, I forget how many people had a chance. Polina, Muniz, Pereira. They all had good chances and just couldn't put it in the back of the net. On the flip side of that, the other way that Fulham play is – we kind of sit back, we absorb a lot, and then we play fast on the break. And when I mean fast, we play, when I coach different kids and stuff, it's play the way you face. So, you know, if you get the ball and your back's to goal, you play it back to a player because that's the way you face. And you just, and he's facing forward, the ball gets played forward, and it's fast, zip, zip, zip passes. And then before you know it, holy shit, we've created something, and the ball's in the back of the net. And that's the way I feel. It's either we slow the game down and not Parker like ball, but almost kind of like Parker like ball, where we slow the game down, we try to get that perfect angle, that perfect damn shot, walk it into the box, you know, or into the goal, or we play really quick zip, zip, zip. And you think, oh my God, this is like, you know, could be in the Europa League, this team, and make things happen. So sadly, and I don't blame Tom, I'm not blaming William. I know a lot of people said they slowed the game down. I don't blame them for the way we played. I think it's just the way we set up for that particular game for whatever reason. I guess because we thought we were at home and we've been doing great at home, we could dominate. So we just said, hey, we're going to control this whole game.
There was noticeable times in that game, Kish, when everyone bar Leno was in the Newcastle half. And from the way we play, that's not giving those sort of intricate wingers those triangles to break things down. There's just too much traffic. Do you think because we started so well, we probably got a little bit overeager, and with Newcastle dropping back into a very compact two lines of four, we just couldn't do anything with it?
Yeah, I mean, it's both a blessing and a curse, right? Marco's got to a place with this team where, particularly at home, I think he feels that he can dominate anybody. And in the first two thirds of play, I think Fulham are playing as well as anybody in the league this season. You know, there a lot is often made of Roberto De Zerbi and the way in which Brighton progressed the ball and the speed at which they move from one side of the pitch to the other and cut through opponents when they try and press them. There's a lot of that in what Marco's doing with this Fulham team. You'll see that when Newcastle, in the first sort of 25 minutes of that game, tried to press, and they're a good pressing side and they've done it for a long time under Eddie Howe. When they tried to do that, there were a couple of times we cut them to ribbons and we created those sort of fast moments that Coach Don, who was channeling Coach Beard earlier, was telling us about. And look, I think teams have started to realise that you actually probably have to sit off this Fulham side. And that's in many ways a compliment to the job Marco's done and the job we've done in establishing ourselves as a mid-table Premier League side. Last season, I don't think many teams thought they needed to sit off us at all, and that sort of helped us on our way. So, you know, you can say, oh, should we have played a different way? You can sort of only play the opponents as they come at you. And I think after the first few times that we cut through them with our progression and our quick passing, Eddie Howe, after an infamous timeout, decided no more of that. And the pattern of the game then swung into something that we've seen a lot recently and perhaps don't really like.
It's looking at the momentum charts as well, it's very weighed one way, and that is Fulham for most of the game. There's a few moments towards the end of the first half following that thing we're going to get to. But then second half, it was reasonably easy. And looking at some of those charts and my memories of the game, it was one of those things that just felt like we weren't playing badly, but we weren't going to get this. And let's get to that moment. So what was it? 21 minutes, I want to say.
For the first one.
Yeah. So dear, I've got it written down as timeout / cheating / tactics / shithousery. So basically, goalkeepers go down, the game has to stop. That's the rule.
Was it just goalkeepers, though?
Or head injury, I think. Those are the two things. But if it's...
We had a couple different field players go down, too, where they were holding the back of their calves or different shit and, you know, constantly...
Let's worry about the first one, because there's enough of those to go. We'll be here all day. But the one that sort of has made all the talking is the Dubravka. There we go. I'll get it right in the end. I'm just going to put this here first. It was an opportunity that was taken, and it gave them something that allowed them to readjust. And to be fair, it still took them a little bit of time to make work and get into that better sort of last sort of 15 minutes of the first half. Now, quick raise of hands. Well, we won't do raise of hands because it's a podcast. You won't be able to see it. If Marco had done that, would it have been clever? Or would it have been cheating? Because our group chat, and to be fair, I did quite happily stoke it on Saturday evening because I was barbecuing and I was bored. if it had been Marco, would we be calling it clever? Is this one of these things that my old rugby master was saying, it's only cheating if you get caught sort of thing? Kish, what's your take on what Eddie Howe did?
So look, the first thing is we need to try and work out what Eddie Howe actually did. So did Martin Dubravka feel anything in his leg? Because Eddie Howe was very, very open in saying that actually it was a good opportunity. We got the boys in. They had a chat on the sidelines. Marco said that he could see that Newcastle were telling Dubravka to go down. Were they telling Dubravka to go down because he felt something? Or did they tell Dubravka to go down because they wanted him to feel something? Now, the honest answer is, I don't think anyone other than Martin Dubravka and maybe Eddie Howe or his coaching side really know what that was.
Stop being sensible. Just tell us what your gut's telling you.
If there was nothing, if there was no pain, no injury, no nothing, it's cheating because he's invented an injury that doesn't exist. If there is any time that the goalkeeper has got anything wrong with him and they've told him to go down, it's not cheating because the rules allow you to do that and say the game has to stop for a goalkeeper. And the goalkeeper is not going to be told to go off for 30 seconds after he's received medical treatment because that would be chaos. Although what wonderful chaos that would be if we made that a rule in the Premier League. Would I have liked it if Marco had done it? No. It's not really what I'm into. Some people love what we might call shithousery and worship it and think Diego Simeone is wonderful and great entertainment. It's not my cup of tea. I'm not a fan of it. I'm not sure it's quite cheating, but it's not really the way I like to see the game played. Others might feel differently.
Now, see, that you're right. It's not cheating. It's bending the rules to take advantage of them to its full capacity, okay? And what I've learned, I was talking to my son and on his friends and stuff, you know, who were in their early 20s, mid 20s. Me, I'm in my later mid 50s.
Later 20s.
Yeah. You know, what I'm finding is if you're older like me, most of us feel it's old school. You know, you don't cheat. There's good gamesmanship. You just don't pull shit like that. And there's a difference between the way they did it and shithousery. I want to get that out there right now. Shithousery to me, the king of shithousery was Steph. And that was grab a person's arm, get the yellow, take them down, break up the play, that kind of stuff. Or, you know, lesser known or lesser observed, Bobby Reed is another good one. Like walked up and fucked with the goalie's gloves and started undoing the cuff, you know, just so he had to stop and redo his cuff of his goalie gloves. That's kind of shithousery. When you start doing things like this, where you tell players, oh, go down for me so that we can have a chance to talk or do this or that, you know, that's cheating. And so if you watch, there's plenty of video out there. You don't have to Google hard, you know, or look hard to find it online where the players are down for Newcastle, the goalie and different ones. And they're literally looking over to the sidelines constantly to see, are they done talking? Are they done talking? The minute the team's done talking, oh, get me up. Let's go play. And nothing's wrong all of a sudden. That gets under my skin. That drives me nuts. That is cheating, plain out flat cheating. And it's the same way with things like Sergio Ramos and what was his name? Onslow, whatever. When they were playing for the coach that is a shithouse coach of all, Jose Mourinho. And Jose Mourinho in the quarterfinals, or no, I'm sorry, in the early stages of the championship before going into the knockout, realizes that the two players are both on yellows and they would carry it into the knockouts. And so he tells them both, hey, I want you to get another yellow card so that you're ejected from the game. That way it doesn't carry over. That's cheating to me, okay? And I don't like that kind of stuff.
Having grown up and spent the first part of my life watching hockey and knowing that the hockey equivalent of what happened there was somebody dropping the gloves and having a fight, you know, that's the thing. You buy your team a moment, you try to change the momentum by doing something like that. I guess that's kind of in the back of my head. Now, in this case, my concern wasn't that Eddie Howe did that. It was that we didn't really react to it well. And by that, I mean, make a tactical change on top of that to regain that momentum. Because it was quite clear for the rest of the first half, whatever it was they did was working. And that is why we have Kish with us, because he makes it make sense. So what did they do And why could we say it only worked for the rest of that first half? Because again, it got pretty even Stevens for the second until the goal.
Well, let's come on to the second half in a minute, because I think to understand the second half, we need to talk about the subs. And I think the subs were, from Marco, were pretty interesting and slightly divisive online from what I could see. In the first half, and I haven't gone back and watched the full 90, because to be honest, I didn't want to subject myself to it for this one. I, in the stadium, was pretty convinced that they committed to the press a lot less after that tactical break, shall we call it. And looking at the numbers, they sat off more than they would on average. And I'm pretty sure that coincided with that point from Howe. And I think he basically said, stop committing to the press, stop giving them what we might call artificial transition. So moments that look like counterattacks because we've broken through that first bit of the press. Sit off a bit and see if they can create something in settled possession. And when they can't do that, get it up the other end very quickly. And the problem we have is that there isn't really a tactical switch you can make that magically breaks down teams when they sit in a block. No one's worked it out. If you talk to the best managers of the best clubs in the world and say, you're playing Sean Dyche, he's going to sit off in two banks of four, how are you going to break it down? They have ideas, but really it's about individual player quality. And that's where suddenly Fulham, who are a mid-table team, don't have those magicians, other than maybe Willian, who is coming to the twilight of his career, who will break through that. And it's not so much that we didn't adapt to it. I think Marco did try something in the second half, which we'll come to. But we ended up playing the game that we all have seen over and over again, which is lots of ball, lots of shuttling from side to side, not as many clear-cut opportunities, and a lot of frustration. And without that absolute sort of game-breaker, creative player, or a striker or a midfield player who you feel like can do something magical, be it smash it in from 30 yards or dance past the team and score one of their own making, we didn't have a response. And unfortunately, I think that's something that teams have worked out. Teams now know how to play Marco Silva's Fulham. And like other coaches in the league who've done well, he's going to have to find a way to solve that.
It's interesting looking at your thread on the game, which is basically what I and many others use to sound clever. The crossing to no one statistic that you've put up is always one that worries me, that we do have players that can put a decent ball in. A lot, especially in that first half, there was a lot of ball going into... I played seven aside last night. I could have hit some of those crosses. My passing was so bad. Is this something that we're seeing more of? That maybe we weren't before, because I think we had opportunities in the past with some decent balls, but there was some crap on offer on Saturday. Don's looking disagreeing.
Yeah, hold on. No. Here's my thing. To be fair, that is something that Fulham has done for years. Okay. There's been lots of times where we constantly were getting a ball put across the box. And this is more prior to Metro, you know, coming into the team, and nobody would be there, you know, not just the person playing on the backside of the, you know, goal or the front side of the goal, but having people staggered across the whole net so that if the first person misses, the second one cleans up, or the third. We just don't have, we've not had those runners consistently over the years that make the runs into the box expecting that cross or that through ball or something to come in. And that's something I drives me nuts. I've always complained about, and this is something that I always teach the kids. Okay, if so and so is coming at the goalie, and he's either going to go straight at the goalie or he's looking to put a cross in, you don't want just one person coming in the box. You want two or three. And the reason being, and they stagger, you know, different levels and different lengths, because if the goalie does get the ball and he spills it, you want somebody there to clean it up. We don't do that. We haven't done that consistently for years.
I mean, the one period of time which we did do that consistently was what I call the 5-0 era. And in the 5-0 era, what we started to do, I called it an era, it was a few games, but it felt like it was such a momentous, wonderful thing in my life. But, you know, the 5-0 era, what we would do is we'd look for underlaps, we'd cross the ball closer to the box than we did, at least in the second half of this game. We'll come on to that in a minute. And we'd have runners going front post, penalty spot, back post. And that's where a lot of our goals came from. I think we did the first half of that pretty well in the first half. I think there were quite a lot of underlapping runs. We were hitting them. We were getting decent balls in. The flooding the box bit wasn't there. In the second half, because Newcastle sat off and made things so narrow and concentrated and horrible. Marco decides that we're going to have to go around the outside of them and we're going to have to cross the ball from further away. And that's when you got the sort of this farcical period of play where Harry Wilson had come on, Adama Traore had come on, sometimes Jedi, sometimes Alex Iwobi, were sort of endlessly spamming crosses in, often were sort of met by Dan Byrne, who, to be fair, is bigger than everybody else on the pitch, or won us a corner, or went to nobody. And I feel that that second half period is where the crossing really fell apart for me. And that's because in sort of desperation, we tried to change things. And I'm not sure whether the way that we tried to change them was really that sensible.
Because one of the things that when it happens, so 65 minute, we get Traore, Wilson and Lukic come on. So Lukic on for Kearney, Traore for Pereira and Wilson for Willian. There's been talk of people wanting to see Wilson on the left. We got that. And I guess it was a bit of a case of don't always get what you wish for, because unfortunately poor old Harry did not shine over there for his cameo. And it's interesting that the Kearney for Lukic thing, it just felt like it dragged everything back a bit. It opened things up in the wrong way. I felt the our press dropped just basically because of that, looking for that ball onto the penalty spot or the onto the keeper, and it just wasn't happening. Don, you furrowed brow again, which means this is good conflict. Come on, this is what the listener wants. Tell me I'm wrong.
I'll be really interested to hear Kish's take on this. Here's my thing. He made three subs all at once. If you want to disrupt the entire game, change, you know, a third of the team all at once. So in other words, why not change one thing? Give it 5 minutes. I know it could be longer, but give it 5 minutes and let's see if he can settle into what's going on and make a change. Don't change the whole thing and expect, boom, like that, everything's going to be golden and magical and something's going to happen. So for me, it was too much at once, period. And I know, Kish, maybe I'm wrong, but I didn't think Pereira was doing that bad. He's still, maybe he's not putting it in the back of the net, but he still creates. And him, Tom, and Willian together, they do really well with quick little passes and flicks. I know everybody again says, oh, but they slowed the game down. Yeah, well, they did better than what the second half team did to me, so.
Don, where are you in H5 when I need you? I mean, H5 hates Andreas Pereira, right? I'm just going to say it. H5 does not like Andreas Pereira. I love Andreas Pereira.
That's why I got my seat there, mate. That's exactly why.
Well, I clearly didn't see that on the application form to get my season ticket there. I mean, to be fair, Andreas wasn't at the club when I did. But, you know, yes, the problem is when it goes badly for Andreas, it looks so bad because it's the shot that goes into row Z or the pass that randomly goes out of the touchline that it looks really, really bad. And all the sort of good stuff that he does in between kind of gets lost. But look, I'd love to have sort of a fake argument with you, Don, because it would be good pod. But I agree with you completely. I think there was a touch of desperation about Marco there, which is, I've seen this film many times. We don't score doing this. I need to try something else. And what he went for was width and traditional wingers and getting the ball into the box and seeing what would happen. A manager who's confident that his team can break down sides just keeps going. I mean, people find them very boring at times, but watch Mikel Arteta's Arsenal. They'd let sort of their version of Tom Cairney, Martin Odegaard, sort of keep on doing his sort of slow passing, sort of metronomic thing, camped in the opponent's area and trust that at one point it's going to go right and they're going to get a goal. And I think Marco had no faith that we were going to do that and decided to go for something completely different. But, I mean, you can see it on my Twitter feed at Cottage Tactico, cheeky plug as ever. But, you know, the structure completely breaks down after those three substitutes. We're going for chaos in hope of a goal. And unfortunately, I don't think that that's really that sustainable. And the problem we find is that when you lose control, if you want to play chaos, is your defence good enough to put up with the fact that every now and then it's going to come back the other side very, very quickly? No, Fulham's defence are not that good. They can't do what some of the other sides do and to sort of just tough it out the other way. If you lose control of a game like we did in the second half, you're going to pay the consequences for it. And unfortunately, I think it was, for my eyes at least, with hindsight, a tactical misstep from our very, very good manager.
I agree completely. And so again, it's, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. But for me right now, Harry Wilson is just not consistent. He has his game and a half of brilliance, and then just kind of goes disappearing magic act. He's there, but I don't know what he's doing. My thing would have been one sub at a time, bring off, I forget who he brought off for, to put Harry on, but I would have put Bobby on. You know, Bobby seems to pop up better and create chances and make things happen to me. He's not that full 90-minute guy anymore, but he seems to be a lot luckier, you know, and getting things and making things happen. So Bobby would have been in there for me. If you really wanted to change the game, no offense to Lukic, I think he's actually a pretty good player. I'd have thrown Reed in there, you know, Harrison. I'd just run around, chase everything down. He's that one guy that maybe he gets the ball in the right area and puts a ball in and creates something. So I just, my changes would have been different, completely different.
Well, I think our issue is even with a few of those subs, we come back to my hobby horse on this is we tend to lack that plan B. You know, if things aren't unlocking, we don't have something we can fall back into. And you know, the clear sign of desperation after the goal was bringing on Brozier and Jimenez, which to be fair was the sort of Hail Mary thing that I always like. 5 minutes before the end of the game is probably a bit late to throw that pass, but it, you know, I did sort of think this could be the chaos that we were wanting, having literally every striker.
See,
in the
my
club
conspiracy on that. I have a conspiracy on that. See, the other reason he brought Polina off is because he doesn't want him to get another yellow.
Well, come on, let's face it. You've been wanting this 15 yellow cards for all time. So it'll make you happy when it happens, Don.
No, I don't want it to happen. That's the scary thing is I really don't want him to miss any of the remaining games because there are some pretty good ones in there. But yeah, again, tell me if I'm wrong, Kish. You would probably saw more than me, especially if you were there. He still isn't consistently, Polina, going in for those bone-crunching tackles. Like, he did a couple. Like, they weren't bone-crunching, but very important. Put the right foot in at the right time. But he's just not that guy who, right now, like we had in the beginning of the season, middle of the season.
Look, I don't know if it's to do with producer Don's favourite hobby horse, which is the 15 yellow cards, which Fulham Focus fans drink. It has happened. But I don't know if it's to do with that, but he does seem slightly less aggressive than usual. I thought he did crunch in a little bit at the weekend. I mean, he's still probably our best player. He's perhaps not the Superman he was last season at points, but also we're not asking him to be. I mean, if you have 68% of the ball, you're not going to need João Polina thundering in the same way that he did last season, which I think is an interesting point in relation to supposed interest in him coming in the summer. Because if you put him into a team that has 60, 70% of the ball regularly, do you lose a lot of what makes João Polina João Polina? And if that's the case, are we really going to be getting these astronomical offers that supposedly were on the table for him in the summer? I'm actually not that convinced of that. And it's probably one for another podcast. But, you know, I'm not sure the interest and the money is going to be there in the way that we quite expect it with Joao. Not because he's stepped off, but just because he's good at a specific thing. And even we are seeing limits to that sort of specific thing now that we actually can have a bit of ball.
But the flip side of that is the reason we've got the possession is because of what he's doing. So that when they do have the break, he puts the hammer down, stops it, and lets us get the ball back and keep going with possession. So that's the flip side of that. So when people say, like you, and I'm not saying it's not wrong, trust me, I'm not saying you're wrong. But for me, he still fits into that mold because he can be that holding guy that still makes sure I keep all the pressure off when they do get the break on my center backs and my back four, you know, or I'm the one that allows, because I'm sitting back, Robinson to go bombing down the field because I can be there to help cover that and break that up as a counter. So he's still, even I think in those kind of situations, and this is where people say, I don't think he's that player. He can't go to Real Madrid or you know, Bundesliga and be with the big boys. I disagree. I think that kind of role, when you find that person that can do that role, there's just no amount of money that, you know, you can spend to fill that.
I think what's going to be an interesting sort of hypothetical to watch is Arsenal-Bayern over these next few Champions League games to see how a Polina would fit into that. Because you're going to have Arsenal.
Oh, no. Are you not in the know? It's going to be West Ham.
No, please.
And they're coming for Tosin too.
Well, we're going to come on to that. But let's wrap this up. So we've got some stats from Sam. We won't talk about Newcastle winning all the games against Fulham because we don't want to. But this is the first time we've lost consecutive Premier League games since December and first time that we haven't managed to score since the Everton game in January, which I hadn't realised and actually has made me feel pretty good, actually. You know, things haven't been great the last few games, but yeah, on the whole, it's been a good spring so far. 63.7% share of possession was the highest we've had in a Premier League game since we lost to West Ham in 2003 when we had 76.6. Now, my final question for this is this performance potentially slight on the beachism? We're basically safe now. Is this a mid-table team who's used to looking over their shoulder to get away from relegation instead of having a mentality looking up? Could it be a little bit of, let's see this one out and get to Dubai?
So do you think, I'm not trying to go off on a tangent here, but do you not think that the players get some kind of bonus or extra money at the end of the season for every position that they can get higher? Because I would think that would be a big incentive to the players. Oh, I get X amount more if we can get 10th or 8th or 9th or whatever, you know? I'm just trying to think of not just, yes, I do think they're on the beach, but it's like, well, how do you prevent this in the future? You know, how do we give them incentive to keep going the entire season and not just say, well, we're on 38 points, 39 points, we're safe, you know, let's just cruise along and I don't want to get hurt because I want to go to Dubai and do all my whatever sports, water sports and stuff. So
I'm a big fan of incentive-based contracts. I still think Nelson Piquet at Benetton in 92, when he was basically getting paid 100 grand a point and he won a bunch of races. Good man. But Kish, what's your sort of feeling on this? Is it that sort of moment when everybody is like, okay, we're good, and they have to sort of get themselves up and going again?
I don't see on the beach, if I'm honest. What I saw midweek against Forest was complacency. I think they turned up thinking they'd roll them over pretty easily and got a nasty shock in that opening sort of 25, 30 minutes before Marco made the subs. And I think that was pure complacency. I don't see a performance like the first half an hour against Newcastle and think this is a bunch of players who don't really care anymore. I mean, it was pretty high octane stuff from Fulham, lacking that final bit of quality. The only thing I did see was that the reaction after the goal that wasn't, which we haven't mentioned, which was a foul, so I'm glad that they chalked that off, and the reaction after the goal that was quite soon after, I didn't see a lot of fire. I saw a lot of slump shoulders, a lot of here we go again, dominating a team, not getting the goal, being punished for it. I saw a lot of frustration, a lot of disappointment. And I didn't see that absolute desperation to think, my God, we're going to go and get them off the back of this. I don't know if that's because the incentive isn't there or if it's just that there's a slight lack of belief when Fulham go a goal down or when the same pattern seems to repeat itself. But I don't think that it's that they don't care. I haven't seen that yet, if I'm being brutally honest.
Good. There you go. You're quite right to raise the elbow on Tosin as well, because when I saw it, it was like, or was it Bassey?
It was Bassey.
It was Bassey.
And I was really surprised he didn't really put up a fuss or anything.
He tried to get back onto the goal line, which I thought was fair play.
No. What I mean is, after the goal, he did not. A lot of players would have been, you know, going to the ref, you know, flailing their hands around going, hey, he snuffed me. He you know, elbowed me down. That's why I was out. And he didn't. He went straight for the ball instead and was like, we're getting back in this game.
Wait, again, also shows, fair enough, we can get in this. I think you were probably watching the same thing I was. Was it Darren Bent doing the colour commentary who was convinced it shouldn't have been chalked off? But I think foul in the build-up, especially one elbow to the neck, definitely a foul. What do you think, Kish?
Yeah, no, it's a foul for me. And then the other thing, if we're doing due diligence before we close the chapter on Newcastle at home, which I'm sure we're all very keen to do, a little bit of chat about Bernd Leno. Sort of both a couple of, well, one of the goals at Forest, a few people grumbling online after the goal this weekend. I mean, he's definitely not hitting the heights that he was, that we needed him to, frankly, last season. I still think he's a net plus for a team where Fulham are, even if he's not quite as super as he was. What do you guys think about Leno at the moment?
I don't think he's top of his game, but like you said, I'll take a 65-70% Bernd Leno any day of the week. There's something not quite right. I wonder if there's looking ahead to Euros and things, and him maybe feeling that his chance is gone. So there's something maybe there. That's the thing that's been in the kind of my head, because the goalkeeper debate in Germany is continuing, and he's not in that conversation at all, which I think is nuts. But that's my feeling. I think the end of the season will probably do good for a nice reset there. Don?
See, for me, you could say the same thing about players not being on top of their game about pretty much the entire squad. And I think that's our problem right now, at least for the last several games, 3-4 games. It's that curse everybody was talking about. Fulham gets to 39 points and go on a 4 streak or whatever, 5-6 game run of not being able to get to 39, get to 40, we're on 39, we can't get to 40, whatever. But yeah, Leno's not top of his game, but I could say the same thing about a lot of people. Tosin, I don't think he's on the very top of his game right now. Casanega, who I love, but he's not quite on top of his game, There's a lot of players you could say that about.
Castagna not on his top of his game is still better than Tete playing at all.
Well, yeah, but my point is, if you look at like if you looked at the heat map or whatever that Kish pointed or posted from that one guy, we're still going down Robinson's side, A, because he's faster and he can do it more often. But, we're just not seeing a lot out of the other side. And part of that is not putting Castaneda down or anything like that, but he can't duplicate what Robinson does. So there's a lot of players, I think, again, not trying to pick on any one single player, like I'm not trying to pick on Leno, that aren't on top of the game. We just notice it more with Leno because when balls are coming at him, he's not that guy who's making the shot stops, making the incredible saves or, blah, blah, blah. So I just think when a goalie's off, it's more noticeable, a lot more noticeable. Where, when Tom's off, because we don't hardly see him as much, we're like, well, that's just Tom.
That's because he's making sure his hair's all right for telly.
Whatever.
Now, the boys in the group chat, Tristan and Sam, did point out that last year, when we got to about this point, we did lose 4 games. So it's, maybe there's something there. Maybe we're reading.
So Fulham is consistent.
Yeah, we're
Fulham is consistent.
We reach safety and we fluff a few appearances. Anyways, let's talk about West Ham briefly. We don't have a great record going away to West Ham. Over the past 12 games, the Hammers have won 8 and drawn 4. And that goes back to 2001. Following their 5-0 win at the Cottage, Fulham are looking to complete the first double over West Ham since, when do you think? Oh, you guys know this. You got in the same group. 1965, 1966, dear listeners. So there we go. That would be nice to do it. And let's have a look. Sam sent a whole pile of really fun stats, which I'm going to seed in as my own over the next little while. But the last 4 London derbies, 41 games, we've lost most of them, ladies and gentlemen. So, what are we going to get? Gents, how are we feeling going into this one?
My takeaway from Sam's, the stuff that Sam's done over.
I'm stealing those in a minute. Don't steal my thunder from Sam making me look good here, Don.
Well, you got to mention, it's not just West Ham that we don't have a good record against. It's also David Moyes.
Yeah, that's what I was going to feed in.
You got to mention both.
Yeah, well, dear old Gollum, he's won 20 of 38 versus Fulham, which is not bad. I don't like him, but he does a job. But with everything that's going on at the moment, and considering I'm looking back, the last time I hosted this pod, I put in out into the world my little sort of, I think we're going to win 5 more games. And so far I've been wrong for the first couple of them. What did I put down for West Ham here? I said we were going to draw, which means we're either going to lose or win. It's not going to be what I predicted. So what are you feeling, Kish? Because West Ham seem to be a little bit all over the place. They're a bit like us at the moment. They're either great or they're not. What's your feeling? Are you going?
I am going. Ah. And the good vibes about this is that the last time I went to an away game was Old Trafford. Which I say on every pod because I'm just very smug that I was there for the grand moment of the season.
Last time I went to Old Trafford, it was shit.
Yes, sorry about that. So, the thing that's really interesting about this one is that we've spent, because of Sheffield United, Forest, and then what Eddie Howe did after Martin Dubravka's moment, we've been talking about teams sitting off Fulham and the problem that causes us, and the problem that we have when we have loads of the ball and a team that doesn't want to press us. And lo and behold, the next game we have is West Ham United. Even in their own gaff, they tend to do that, much to the sort of disgruntlement of the locals at times when it comes to David Moyes. They're going to sit off us. You're talking about stats earlier. I've got a stat for you, which is that PPDA, this is the amount of passes that you have before somebody tries to sort of tackle you or whatever. West Ham allow teams to have the third most passes before a defensive action out of anyone in the league. The only teams that sit off more, because it's a metric that tells you whether teams are pressing or sitting off. The only teams that sit off more are Sheffield United and Nottingham Forest. Oh dear, we've just gone and done that. So this is going to be a test on all of the things that we've just said Fulham are struggling with. I think we're going to have a go at that again. And it's on Marco and the players. Can they work it out? And again, the thing that's slightly worrying is that what West Ham do have is a huge amount of individual quality in the final third for those rare attacks that they do have. The likes of Lucas Paquetar and Jared Bowen and Kudus and sort of these players who can sort of make quite a lot happen out of not much possession. It's going to be a workover of the exact things that we've been struggling with. And I'm fascinated to see if anything changes or if there's any sort of bright ideas as to how to make that more effective for us.
They've got Leverkusen on Thursday, which Thursday? Tomorrow when this goes out, isn't it? Yeah. So there's, you know, hopefully that's gonna be a game for them. Don, how do you feel?
I would think Thursday's match, the quarterfinal or what is it, semifinal, quarterfinal, I believe, for them, it's going to be pretty important. I would think West Ham would be looking to try and get a trophy in the case. So they're fairly comfortable in the, if I'm not mistaken, in their standings as far as the Premier League go. So at any rate, I'm hoping maybe a few changes because they're looking to the next one for next week's second leg of that whole match. And then they've got a couple injuries, you know, our ex-goalie, he's hurt. You know? Do you know who I'm talking about?
We are, but we're not talking about him.
Okay. And then Bowen's out too, from my understanding. So, but isn't he out a lot? Isn't he one of those players that...
The thing that's in the back of my mind is that there is what's happening from about 10th through to 6th is quite a tight little battle in table. So it's, you know, even with the distractions of Europe and things like that, 6th place is up for grabs for them, Newcastle, the other lot in West London, and Brighton are in that sort of shout as well. So I think it's as much as we would like them to be concentrating on Europe like they did last year to win major trophies. Apparently, I think they're very much
personally. I kind of disagree. I think they're kind of safe in where they are. They're going to probably end up either 6th, 7th, or 8th. They're kind of in that loop. They're out of reach, I think, for 5th. I think Aston Villa is kind of pulled away, and they're not going to be able to get into that region. And then Chelsea, you know, sitting down there in 9th. I don't know. It's Chelsea. I think they'll still have some problems, and I don't think they're going to go much higher. So, personally, I think West Ham are pretty much where they are. They're either going to be like around that sixth, seventh, eighth position when they finish. So
cue Chelsea going on a burn now that Don said that.
But. Yeah, exactly.
Don't speak.
They're
going to
win the league.
Look, the thing that I'm slightly worried about is that they could well be out of the Europa League by the time we play them, because they're playing Leverkusen, who, for my money, are actually probably the best team in the world at the moment. Like, they are playing unbelievably well. So it could be that they're on a hiding to nothing by the time they come to us. They'd have certainly had some practice sitting in against Xabi Alonso's Bayer Leverkusen, who sort of passed the ball to death like nobody else. It's a funny game. We keep on hearing that sort of supposedly West Ham are in for sort of half our team and our manager and think that they deserve to have them at their place. It'll be lovely to turn them over just to sort of remind Marco that the grass definitely isn't greener over in East London, don't you think?
It would be nice. I'm just looking at the results.
It's not greener. It's just a bigger.
Hey, all I know is I pay for that grass. let's be fair. Anyone who's paid taxes in London over the past 10 years, yeah, West Ham, you're welcome. But their home form is draw, draw, draw.
And that's where I see us. I think we're going to end up drawing.
Okay.
I really do. I think we're going to get lucky that we will have some type of breakaway build-up play, and we'll get that goal. Muniz will do a backwards flip bicycle scissor kick and get us a goal.
As long as it can bounce off his ass, as long as it goes in, I really don't mind. I don't know. I'm not going to call this because I've called everything wrong this year. So there you go. I said we'd beat Spurs at the beginning of the year, and we didn't. So,
well, normally I would be like, I want to happily say we're going to go in because we have just fluffed it too many times now. We're going to go in, and this is going to be the game. We are going to just 2-1 or something. But I'm just not feeling it. So sorry,
Kish. You're there. You've got to be. You've already jinxed it by saying the last time you went away, we had an epic day. So,
yeah. I mean, you said also that last time we got to this stage in terms of points last season, we ended up losing four. Well, we've lost two, so we're halfway there. If you want to be negative, look, there's some individual things to look forward to here, right? So I'm looking forward to Polina versus Paqueta. I think that could be a lot of fun. An attacking midfielder as good as anything outside of the big boys, and a defensive midfielder who's exactly the same for us. I think that's a really good matchup. I think also that we mentioned Muniz and sort of goals going in off any part of him that he wants. I mean, it's two without a goal, isn't it, for him now? The last one he scored was that unbelievable bicycle kick. Again, the rest of the season, if we might think players are on the beach, it's his chance to sort of prove that he really is what he's sort of threatened to be. So it's another chance for him to nab a goal and show us that he really is our number nine of the future, and maybe someone else's number nine of the future if he really lights it up. So I think it could be quite a good game. And I'm fascinated by what Marco chucks out for this one, because I think both in that triple sub, the much discussed triple sub against Forest and the triple sub against Newcastle, we've seen a little bit of desperation from Marco. And I'm sort of, I always try and guess the lineup every week. I don't really know what he's going to go for against West Ham. I don't really know. I think I could probably guess the back four. But, you know, going forward, I think that there's some real question marks as to what he thinks is the best way to try and break down a side who are likely to sit in. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on who we might see trotting out at the Olympic Stadium. Is that what they call it?
London Stadium, something.
That one.
Yeah. I just
supposedly they put a bid in to actually buy, you know, so.
Oh, well, I'm sure they've been saving their pennies.
I think they feel guilty. They've been taking your taxes, so they want to buy the stadium now.
The joy of having moved down to Sussex, I just probably think, oh, my taxes go to Brighton. I don't know. I don't know. I think it's going to be interesting. I think we won't see Kearney. We'll probably see Paulinho and Lukic. I suppose probably be there in the middle.
That's what I'm thinking.
I think up front we'll see the usual front four.
For whatever reason, I think Reed has kind of fallen off the lineup side, the ticking order. I think Tom's going to come off, which I don't necessarily agree with, you know. But it depends on the tactic you're going to go with. Again, if you're looking for somebody who is going to be more fast attacking and recovering, I think Lukic is your guy. If you're looking for somebody who's going to slow the play down, try and help you break them down, make that killer pass that produces something, in my mind, you slot in Tom. I personally would like to go back to, because I didn't think it was that bad, Iwobi out on the right-hand side and William back on the left. I think that's kind of our most creative. Kish, you can tell me I'm wrong again, but I think that's kind of our most creative three right now, with Pereira sitting in the number 10. So
the problem I have is that I'm firmly of the view that what we saw against Newcastle to start with is our strongest side, right? I like the balance of Kearney in with Polina, particularly if we think we're going to have a bit of ball. I think it sort of livens up our left-hand side even more. I like Iwobi out on the right. Like I, for me, if you were saying to me, what's Fulham's strongest team? I'd say it's what we did at home to Newcastle. Didn't really work, except for it did work, but we sort of lost faith because we weren't getting that goal. And I think it's quite an interesting sort of psychological experiment to see how much faith Marco has that his side doing what he wants to do will eventually get him the results that he wants. Because there wasn't an awful lot that was done wrong, I don't think, by that team initially. Some of the passes got a bit sloppy. The pace dropped a little bit. We didn't really know what to do to break them down. But the control, the intent and everything else was there. So I can't really work out if he's going to stick or twist. And I genuinely just don't know.
Well, I'm hoping he sticks, because even on the right-hand side, I thought, you know, Iwobi and Casanega, they hooked up pretty well too. So they're not as often as down a William Robinson side, but it was still there. So
it's going to be interesting to see. I think how badly Thursday goes will play into it. And like you're saying, that Leverkusen side is nuts. So we shall see. Right, let's wrap this up by having a look at what else we have going on in the Fulham world. The Fulham women's team are third in the table, looking quite good. They've had some decent results. Once again, 4-0 over Dartford. Lost to Dulwich, which is not great. But then we have to, I don't know if this got shouted out, but it popped up on my phone. End of March, they beat Crawley 15-0.
I saw that.
So well done, the women. The under-21s are flying in the Premier League 2. They're third at the moment on 35 points behind West Ham and Spurs, both on 39. So that's looking pretty tasty. They're next up against Newcastle on Saturday. They're going up to the tune for that one. And then they play Spurs in April as well. So that makes that all a little bit tasty. And our under-18s as well, who are also in nice place, about fifth in the table in the under-18s Premier League, which I can't really get my head around that there's Premier League under-18s, but there you go. I'm just old. They have got Spurs coming up on the weekend, and they, again, have been okay in form. They got turned over by Sao Paulo in that weird friendly competition thing that they play in. Your part of the woods out in Dallas, didn't they? Didn't end particularly greatly for them there. But never mind. Gentlemen, this has been a pleasure. You won't have me next time. You'll be pleased. We nearly had our resident father today as well. But yeah, he's on daddy duties because, you know, as a father, fathering for J-Mac takes priority over podcasts. But we shall see what happens in the future. Kish, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure as always. Let's hope I haven't cursed the weekend.
Yeah, well, we'll blame you regardless. Don, thank you so much. We hope we haven't given you too much to edit.
No, not a problem.
Super. And ladies and gentlemen, dear listener, as always, please check in on your friends. Make sure everybody's okay. Enjoy the trip out to East London. May there be no train tube strikes, walkouts, things like that. Especially, well, Sunday can be all right. I'm going to the pub on Saturday up at Borough Market, so you're on your own, dear listener. Until then, take care of yourselves. Come on, you whites. And this has been your Fulham Focus Podcast.
Fulham.